Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott.
Going up.
You're at the dentist, you're uncomfortable, you're bracing for pain, and the dentist seems to be completely unaware and is super chipper.
What I do personally is I jam as many instruments and cotton rolls, and I prop their mouth open, and then I try to have a conversation.
You obviously can't answer, but the dentist doesn't seem to care.
I just have them speak in vowels.
All right, Dennis Bakker-Joffrey is only joking, but he does admit trying to make small talk with his patients is really awkward because it's a one-way street.
If their mouth is open, the only thing they can sound out is like, ah, e, oo, e. And it just sounds like some kind of weird dialogue.
I got a lot of gifts that I like.
Bakker tries to bridge that uncomfortable gap somehow.
I'll make small talk with the patient where it's, you know, they can nod their head, yes, no, shrug their shoulders. I'll sing for the patients. I love Johnny Cash.
I fell into a burning ring of fire.
Anything to make
them
smile.
Down, 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 and the flames went higher, and it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
Those efforts are often in vain because, let's face it, people really hate going to the dentist.
If you could drop your mouth off like your car, it'd be easier for both of us.
Nobody wants to be in that chair, and that makes the job really tough. Dentist Paul Goodman says, imagine you're hanging out with a friend.
And you got the vibe from your friend that they didn't want to be there the whole time. It would be a bad experience. And that dentist constantly just are in the experience of people's energy not wanting to be there. And we're just trying to help you.
In addition, Paul says dentists often work in isolation.
You know, they work in their own little, you know, people call it islands, or one dentist that I've connected with calls it a cave. They work in like their own little cave because it's just set up for dentists to work as solo practitioners. Over 80% are like solo practitioners, over 70%. So they don't really communicate with each other.
They usually don't even know the other dentists nearby.
You work a mile away from someone and never learn their name, never talk to them. It's kind of sad to me.
Paul wanted to bring dentists together, and he started a Facebook group called Dental Nachos. Yeah, the name is silly, but it's supposed to be fun, bring people together, like sharing a plate of nachos. The group has more than 19,000 dentist members all over the country.
To share, to talk, to vent, to ask questions.
I was allowed to join this group, and I started lurking around, getting all this intel on dentists, what they worry about. They talk about stuff like which dental chairs are the best, how to deal with insurance companies, or how you help a patient who's in a lot of pain with cysts under their teeth. So much stuff I never thought about, and a lot of it so closely related to health. It inspired us to do a whole episode on dentistry, our teeth, our health, and why we treat dentistry like a completely separate aspect of healthcare. So one of the things that kept coming up on the Dental Nachos site was Smile Direct Club. It's a trendy teledentistry company that offers 3D printed aligners. It's about one third of the price cheaper than what you pay when you go to an orthodontist. And the dentists were raging about Smile Direct Club, saying that their patients were getting hurt.
Do not put our patients to the risk. Do not take them for granted.
Reporter Jed Slayman checked into what's got dentists so mad.
And don't put plastic aligners on every person who walks through your door.
That's Chad Gahani, head of the American Dental Association. They've been an early and vocal critic of Smile Direct. He says he first heard about it after his patients came in with complications.
There was one particular patient who came to me for a root canal, but besides the root canal, he had a loose tooth. The tooth was just hanging in the air.
He says orthodontics is more complicated than most people realize, and some people just aren't good candidates for aligners in the first place. He doesn't think SmileDirect much cares.
They just feel that they can just put a plastic appliance as if those are nails in the wall, and they just want to align those nails in one condition. The teeth are not like nails in the wall. The teeth are teeth, and the teeth are attached to the jawbone and to the gum and to the head.
Before aligners, he says you need a real clinical evaluation in a dentist's office, and SmileDirect won't give you that.
They are not looking at the soft tissue. They are not looking at the bone condition. They are not looking at the pockets, like how their gum condition is. They are not looking at all of those things.
All orthodontic treatments come with risks. If your gums or jaws have underlying disease, teeth can get moved right out of your mouth. Hidden, impacted teeth and cavities can blow up under aligners, and if teeth don't move in just the right way, your bite goes way off. SmileDirect, though, says the concerns from guys like Chad are overblown, malicious even. When their top dentist talks about the company's detractors, he sounds a bit like he's talking about some kind of mafia.
We don't cater to the organized dentists and organized dentistry. We don't cater to them. They're not our customers.
He's not concerned with dentists, focused instead on customers.
And we give them what they want, not what organized dentistry wants.
If you've gotten an email from SmileDirect with the greeting, "Hello, future grinner," it's probably signed by this guy. He's Dr. Jeffrey Sulitzer, chief dental officer. He's a dentist, owned a few dental practices, and worked in insurance before SmileDirect. To him, the company is all about increasing access to affordable care.
They like the market the way it is. You have to go to them. They're the ones earning the big dollars. They don't want anybody messing with lower fees.
He tells me SmileDirect is simply meeting a consumer need and leveraging new technology to do it in a smarter way. Disruption can ruffle some feathers. So I headed to a smile shop to see what he's talking about. It looks a bit like an Apple store from the outside, in a busy section of downtown. They wouldn't let me record any audio inside, so I just took notes. I walk into a room with a lot of purple and white and sign in on a tablet. They ask what kind of smile I'm after, and then they pull out this big wand attached to a monitor. It's long and white, looks like one of those small vacuums you might use on a couch. It's called an iTero. This audio is from a demonstration. A dental assistant puts one end in my mouth and all around my teeth, flashing this white light. I'm told taking thousands of images a second.
So we're starting on the lower right.
As the wand moves, a 3D rendering of my teeth, plaque, fillings, and all, fills up a screen with an uncomfortably high resolution.
We'll let it process. Perfect.
A supervisor came up and double-checked my scan. I wondered if she was a dentist, and no. Before working here, she tells me she managed a North Face. But after a few clicks around my 3D teeth, she decides everything checks out. I was then shown the price list. Did I want to pay an $1,800 lump sum or do a payment plan? They tell me a dentist will review the scans remotely and give the final okay before my aligners start showing up in the mail. The whole thing took 20 minutes, and there wasn't a single actual dentist in the building. No one told me to see a dentist before my visit or asked if I had one. But when I took a closer look at the paperwork I signed, apparently my dentist was supposed to have played a major role in all of this.
My dentist took x-rays of my teeth. My dentist checked for and repaired cavities. My dentist checked my x-rays and I have no shortened or resorbed roots. My dentist checked my x-rays and I have no impacted teeth. My dentist.
Just by signing, I had checked yes by all these questions.
We do not ask them to prove they've been to a dentist, but they attest that they have been.
That's Jeffrey again, SmileDirect's chief dental officer.
In essence, they say, yes, I've been to the dentist within 6 months. And they check the box and say yes.
I didn't end up getting aligners, but weeks later, I'm still getting robocalls saying my new smile is waiting. So I asked Jeffrey, how do you know for sure I'm a good candidate? Why not get my dentist or any dentist to sign something saying that I am? I tell him that it probably silenced some critics.
They want to make it more like the old model. Yeah, go into a dental office first. Get a signature first. Does that make any sense? What you're trying to do is you're responding to naysayers that are dentists in the communities that are trying to come up with reasons of why this should fail.
He says SmileDirect isn't doctor-focused. They're concerned with the patient or the customer. He uses the terms interchangeably as we talk. And he says, anyway, the company intentionally only takes the easy cases, just moving the front smile teeth. Dentists and organized dentistry just can't stand all the winning.
They're so frustrated because it's not failing. It's not creating problems. It's been so successful and efficacious. They're trying to figure out how they can slow this thing down. So that's really what you're faced with. And we're not going to put up barriers just because they're not happy with our success. It's not going to happen.
SmileDirect is big on social media, and smiling customers, he says, speak for themselves. Reputation is everything.
And in our world, we don't see bad outcomes. I mean, we have over 750,000 cases treated. I mean, when you look at the social media, the results are amazing.
It is actually pretty easy to find loads of real customers posting online about their beautiful SmileDirect smiles. There's a lot on Instagram, a bunch of unofficial SmileDirect Facebook groups, and the majority of the posts are toothy selfies, grateful for SmileDirect's transformation. Oftentimes, orthodontics aren't covered by insurance. It's clear SmileDirect does make the lifelong dream of straight teeth more affordable for more people. But not everyone gets the happy ending. There's posts like this one from a young woman.
Totally regret doing this. My bite has changed drastically. Now I bite in the front middle of my mouth, my back teeth are tilting in, and my bottom front are rubbing my top front.
And others.
My tongue and lips have been torn to shreds, and now I feel like my two front teeth are caving in.
My top gums are inflamed, and I was bleeding a lot. I'm scared to put them back in.
People share symptoms, ask medical questions, stuff more suited for a dentist's office than a Facebook group.
Please reassure me, this is normal.
A bunch of people do, but none of them are dentists. You can, in theory, call your SmileDirect dentist to ask such things, but you have to get through customer service first. The worst cases end up having to walk into a brick-and-mortar orthodontist's office.
I mean, I've had two in the past week and a half.
I'm in Joshua Davis's orthodontic practice in Philadelphia. He says SmileDirect patients/customers will show up with misaligned bites, pain in their jaws.
And I suspect it should pick up even more. I think they do great at marketing, and I don't think the patients are fully aware that it's different from going to an orthodontist office.
At his practice, he's got a room with that same iTero machine SmileDirect has, but it's not all he has.
So that's our sensor for the panoramic x-rays. And on the other side is our sensor for the cone beam CT scans. And then this is our sensor for the lateral cephalometric x-ray.
None of this is cheap, and most every orthodontist is also a small business owner. They have to keep their practices afloat. So I have to ask, is SmileDirect just winning too much? Cutting into your profits? Stealing your customers?
I have about 80 more patients in the afternoon, starting at 1.
So Joshua, at least, isn't feeling the squeeze. He says guys like him and SmileDirect actually can coexist to a degree.
SmileDirect Club couldn't offer low-cost retreatment option for that really slim segment of the population.
Retreatment is basically your parents got you braces, but you couldn't be bothered to wear a retainer, and now you got to tighten up.
But they've taken it and tried to deliver that treatment to the masses, and I think that's inappropriate and unethical.
He says SmileDirect sacrifices safety to get the most paying customers. I asked Jeffrey for SmileDirect's numbers on how many of their patients end up with complications or failed treatments, have to see orthodontists like Joshua.
Well, Let me ask you this. Where are those numbers in traditional practice? Do you have anything to compare them to? And that's the answer. There aren't any.
He's right. Comparable numbers are hard to find. All of this is pretty new. But a couple days after we spoke, a market research firm came out with a scathing report on SmileDirect called Moving Fast and Breaking Things in People's Mouths. They point to review site horror stories and warn crippling state regulations were right around the corner. Far from the future of orthodontics, they warn SmileDirect is about to fizzle out. Their stock did take a hit at first, but then things actually stabilized and recovered pretty quickly in the end. There's even real competitors on the horizon. Braces are still crazy expensive, and people still want perfect smiles.
That was Jad Slayman reporting. Today's episode is about teeth and dentists. So there are these outside companies that are disrupting how dentistry is done and how consumers access those services. But dentists are also trying to innovate their field from within. For example, trying to make dental visits more pleasant. Reporter Matthew Schneeman visited a new dental company called Tend that strives to reshape the entire experience of going to the dentist.
I don't like going to the dentist. I mean, who does? It started when my grandfather told me how painful dental visits were before Novocaine. Can you imagine? But my aversion was cemented not with a bad experience, but a good one. The musical Little Shop of Horrors and Steve Martin's hilarious and unforgettable depiction of a dentist.
I'm your dentist, and I enjoy the career that I picked. I'm your dentist, and I get off on the pain I inflict.
As if pain and discomfort is inextricably linked to dentistry. It seems dentistry has a lot of unfair expectations to overcome. One new chain of dentist offices, called Tend, is trying to do just that. Could it even become a, dare I say it, enjoyable experience? After collecting $36 million in funding, Tend has tried to improve every aspect of going to the dentist.
Dentistry is a pretty remarkable profession. The things that we can do for patients are tremendously satisfying and rewarding.
Mark Schlenoff, dentist and vice president of clinical development for Tend, gave me a tour of their Manhattan office.
Sure. When you first walk in, you're going to be greeted by, you know, very professional people up here at the front.
Yeah, you all look very professional.
Thank you.
Young, well-groomed staff smile in unison as I enter the office.
We're just going to peek in for just a second.
Okay, now, a typical visit at Tend starts at the brushery.
We happen to call it the brushery.
Yes, the brushery.
The brushery.
Radio will not do this justice because it's a beautiful room.
Isn't this cool?
The brushery is an extra room between where you check in and where you get your cleaning. The walls and ceiling are covered in a soothing green and blue wallpaper. You get a new toothbrush and toothpaste so you can brush your teeth to lessen any self-consciousness you may feel before experts stare into your mouth. Just about everything at Tend is designed to be more comfortable. There's no wait time. They have electric tools that vibrate less and don't have that evil drill noise. You know what I'm talking about. They have headphones and Netflix to watch while you get a cleaning. They offer heated eye masks, stress balls, and even nitrous oxide. They have the latest technology. Mark showed me one of the new machines.
Matthew, this is a scanning machine, and it's a substitute for taking impressions.
So that's the gooey putty thing?
Yeah, so I don't think we've taken a gooey putty thing since we've opened.
Is anyone let down by that?
No.
But Mark says all of these neat amenities aren't really what makes the difference.
You know, the number one pain-relieving strategy is just to form a good relationship so that the patient who comes in is not anxious to begin with, because anxiety is pain-inducing. Most of what we do is not, but the preconception that something is going to hurt goes a long way.
It's not just Mark and the people at Tend that feel this way. I checked with other people in the industry, and across the board, they confirmed it. Everyone involved wants you to be more comfortable. Doesn't that feel good?
You'll be a dentist. You have a talent for causing pain.
That was Matthew Schneeman reporting. We're talking about our teeth, oral health, and dentists. What are the challenges they face? Dental school is 4 years. There is an expectation that afterwards you'll have a stable, lucrative career. But nowadays, many dentists find themselves up against a massive financial challenge: student debt. Steph Yin looked into this.
Lori Wilson showed up to her first day of work at a dental clinic wearing some questionable footwear.
I had on these boots, and these boots had heels to it.
And the staff in the clinic, they had this bet. And their bet was that she's not going to last 2 months.
The clinic was in Kotzebue, Alaska, a tundra, 30 miles above the Arctic Circle. It's surrounded by water on all sides, or ice in the winter. Temperatures of minus 80 degrees are normal. Lori's from Florida, and this was a big leap from her comfort zone.
When I got there, I was just like, oh my God, I didn't see any other Black people. It's isolated, and it's dark almost 6 months out of the year. Nothing but complete darkness.
Some patients would drive hours on a snowmobile or RV to see her. Or sometimes she'd fly on a bush plane, then go by dog sled to treat people in remote Eskimo villages. It could get lonely.
I was just like, oh my goodness, what decision did I make?
The decision was financial. Lori had to go this far to stay ahead of her student debt. When she graduated from dental school in 1995, she owed about $300,000. And she picked Kotzebue, Alaska for a very specific reason.
Kotzebue, Alaska was number one on the loan repayment list. That meant if you went there, it was more than likely that you would receive loan repayment.
She had joined a government program called the Public Health Service, which brings medical providers to high-need areas in the country. Those who heed the call can apply for a chance to get help in paying their student loans back. But there's no guarantee. Lori took a gamble when she hopped on that duster plane to Kotzebue. But about 5 months after she arrived, she got the letter she'd been hoping for.
This letter said, congratulations, we're going to pay back some of your student loans. That was the most wonderful thing that I could have ever had sent to me in my life.
For every year Lori stayed in Alaska, the government would pay off $20,000 of her student debt.
All that mattered to me was to get some of this debt paid off. And that's what I did.
Lori ended up staying in Alaska for 3 years. During that time, she made a decent dent on her loans. Debt from dental school is a massive burden on many people. Travis Hornsby is the founder of Student Loan Planner, a financial coaching company that helps people with huge amounts of student debt. And dental school students have always stuck out to him. The typical dental school grad has around $290,000 of student debt. Travis says, remember, that's an average. Some people come from wealth and graduate with little or no debt. So many people owe a lot more.
The typical general dentist that we work with actually close in on about $400,000 of student loan debt. So these are basically mortgages on people's brains.
We might expect actors to struggle, artists, public radio reporters, but dentists, we don't really expect them to have serious financial worries. Travis walks me through some numbers.
If you have almost $400,000 of debt, if you wanted to pay that back in 10 years, it would take you paying about $4,000 a month. So that's approximately $50,000
a year. $50,000
a year.
That's a lot. Now, how much do new dentists make? Dental school grads are facing a tough market. Insurance companies cover very few dental services. And all around the country, adults are just going to the dentist less often. In a competitive job landscape, the starting salary for most dentists is around $120,000. So say you're paying back $50,000 a year on a $120,000 salary.
After taxes, you're probably going to take home about $80,000 or $90,000. And you'd basically have to have more than half of your take-home pay go to debt for 10 years.
In recent decades, dental school tuition has increased much faster than inflation. If you look at what dental school cost in the 80s and adjust it for inflation, today's tuition is 2.5 times that. I called up some dental school deans to understand why. Dean Mark Wolf at the University of Pennsylvania says one reason is that the cost of dentistry in general has gotten more expensive, and dental school has followed suit.
You used to get the x-rays in your mouth taken with film put inside your mouth. Today we put sensors inside the mouth, capture it directly into the computer. Film used to cost a few dollars a pack. That sensor is a $7,000 sensor.
But when I asked where exactly do these tuition dollars go, I got a range of vague answers.
They're not necessarily going to the classroom. So you need public safety, and you need you need to have the halls swept and the bathrooms tended to. All of that is part of the process.
There are salaries, libraries, research, the cost of running the dental clinics that students see patients in. We visited one of the most expensive dental schools in the country, the NYU College of Dentistry. Robert Glickman, one of the deans, gave us a tour of the school's amenities. He rattles off all sorts of expensive, cutting-edge equipment.
Everything is electronic or digital or the latest type of equipment. These CT scans allow us to view images at very, very precise slices, a tenth of a millimeter. Here's this can actually hook up with translators 24/7 over 50 languages.
We also talked to some students. One person said the area we toured was not representative of the whole school.
This is a lot nicer. This is like state of the art, but typically where we're at, it's pretty old, like things are broken.
So we asked, do you think it's worth the $100K per year?
Honestly, I don't think so. I don't think so, but I feel like right now I'm paying for the name of NYU, not so much for the facility and the education.
So I asked the dental school deans for their take.
A lot of people are saying now it's untenable for some people to consider dental school because of the amount of debt there is. So what would you say to that?
Sour grapes.
That's Dean Bruce Donoff from Harvard.
Sour grapes.
Sour what do you grapes. Mean by that? It's still a very popular profession. There are ways to handle debt, scholarships that are available, federal loans for care given to underserved areas. I think there are a lot of programs that could reduce debt for people. But some of the inconsistencies here are a lot of students have very fine cars and live very well and still have levels of indebtedness that were far beyond what I had.
So there's a mismatch in sort of lifestyle and...
There can be. Mm. There can be.
What does student loan coach Travis Hornsby say to that?
I say that's absolute hogwash.
He uses NYU as an example. Right now, the estimated four-year cost on the school's website is nearly $400,000. Now, say a student borrows $25,000 a year for living, penny pinching by New York standards. That already puts us at $500,000. Then there are loan fees, interest, and yearly tuition hikes. Travis estimates all of that would add another $125,000.
So if somebody was an ultra-frugal dental student at New York University Dental School, that person would leave in $625,000 of debt.
On top of that, Travis says, schools often are not transparent in helping students navigate loans. In some cases, they're even outright misleading.
Deans will say something like, the average time to paying back our loans is 7 years. If you look at a high-cost school, like some of the ones that you mentioned, that would take 100% of someone's after-tax income to do that in a seven-year period. So somebody is not being totally truthful.
Travis says by blaming students for their debt, the deans are trying to distract from their own role. Dental schools are a business. Compared with medical school, they tend to attract less money in donations, have smaller endowments.
So dental schools try to increase their revenue basically by charging directly.
Which means dental students will keep taking out loans, even if it's $600,000 or $700,000. Federal Grad Plus loans are not capped, meaning students can take out as much money as they want with no underwriting.
So clearly schools have no limit and no pushback on the price.
But Dean Charles Bertolami at NYU believes that dental school is and will continue to be worth the price tag.
Is dental school expensive? Absolutely. I think it's definitely worth it. It still is seen as a good investment.
Dental school debt doesn't only affect dentists. It could have broader implications for dental care. Lori, who went to Alaska to pay down her debt, now practices at a clinic in Virginia. She worries the high cost of dental school can be a barrier for people entering the profession. Lori is president of a local African American dental society, and she mentors young Black people who want to get into dentistry. Right now, less than 4% of dentists in the U.S. are Black.
You have to understand, too, we actually treat our people. So the African American dentist is very important for the Black community.
So Lori wants more African Americans to join the profession, but she also feels conflicted.
And I sometimes think about, the kids that I'm mentoring, is it right for me to encourage them to come into this profession? And I know how much money they're going to owe. And I think about that a lot of times.
For Lori, dentistry worked out. She sees patients every day and loves it. She feels proud to help people. To her, the answer is to be honest about debt. She urges her mentees to look into scholarships, consider the most affordable dental schools and places to live, even Alaska.
We're trying to make sure that these students understand what they're up against.
And then the decision is up to them.
That was Steph Yin reporting. One way to sidestep the high cost of dental school and still work in the field is to become a dental therapist.
Generally, they can do preventive procedures and drilling, filling, and some extractions.
That's Mary Otto. She wrote about dental therapists, and she told me that in the U.S., dental therapists got their start in 2004 when tribal organizations in Alaska sent people to train in New Zealand, where dental therapy has long been established.
They're often tasked with serving underserved communities, and they work under the supervision of a dentist, you know, as part of a team, but they can go out into communities where the services are needed.
So they could clean my teeth, drill a hole if needed, and pull a tooth.
Yes, these services are extremely needed in many, many parts of the country, in many communities.
And you see that model spreading?
My reporting tells me that it is being adopted by a number of states, yes. And other states are examining it and looking at it.
And do dentists push back against that? Are they happy about it? Because, I mean, I'm thinking if I just spent a boatload of money going to dental school and now some other person comes along and does 2 years of training and then essentially does my job, I might not be all that happy.
That is the way opponents might portray it. Although, you know, the advocates for the dental therapists point out these therapists are expanding the range of the dentists we have and going out and serving people who might not otherwise be served. There are a shortage of dentists who accept Medicaid across the country. They say they can't, you know, that the Medicaid reimbursement rates are too low, the paperwork is, you know, onerous. So there's always been a shortage of care for those patients, and this mid-level provider model would provide care to those underserved communities.
Mary Otto is the author of Teeth, the story of beauty, inequality, and the struggle for oral health in America.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about dentistry. Teeth have a major impact on our health. Decay and infections can spread through the body. Dental pain is horrible. It can make it impossible to concentrate or to work. So all of this is very much a health issue. But do physicians care about our teeth? I checked in with internist Netta Freja. Do you ask your patients about oral health? Do you say things like, who's your dentist? Have you been to the dentist? Do you brush your teeth?
So usually, at best, I'll do it around once a year when I'm seeing my patients for their annual physical or their annual wellness visit. Usually in that visit, do you have a dentist? Do you see your dentist? Those are some of the questions that I ask.
I have never been asked about oral health by any provider that's not a dentist. What do you hear from your colleagues, from other primary care providers? Does this come up?
So I actually did a highly scientific Twitter poll of primary care physicians, and I asked, how often do you ask your patients about their dental care? We had 162 people respond, and 7% said they ask about it at every visit. 49% of them said that they ask at the annual physical. 17% said around once every 5 years or so very infrequently. And then 27% said they never ask about dental health. And I think it's very easy for most medical professionals to say, oh, well, if it's in your mouth, if it's your teeth, someone else is taking care of it. Another big reason why we don't always ask our patients about their oral health, is our training. You know, Mike, and I think I had maybe 2 lectures in medical school on the teeth. I think maybe in my clinical years of medical school and residency, I interacted once or twice with oral surgeons and got to see what they were doing. But other than that, it just wasn't a big part of all of the training that my friends and colleagues and I went through.
So how did this happen? How did dentistry and medicine become 2 different animals? Separate schools, separate professional organizations, even a whole separate insurance system. Reporter Alana Gordon looked into this division a while back.
Dr. Andrew Spielman is an associate dean at New York University's School of Dentistry.
By and large, dentistry is very unique that they even carved out a separate insurance from the rest of the body.
He says this separation, this difference from medical insurance, goes deep into the history of the field itself.
And that actually go back to the 11th century.
Up until the 1800s, dentistry was kind of in the background. Teeth were an anomaly.
Unlike bone, teeth do not regrow and do not fuse. They seem to be inert, almost dead, and therefore nobody really bothered with it. So it was pretty much where medicine gave up on teeth and said, this is something that we don't deal with it.
It became more of a craftsman's trade. Barbers, surgeons, wig makers, even blacksmiths would perform dental work.
You have this group of individuals who pretty much pick up a plier and pull teeth without much training or instruction. So it was really a free-for-all type of thing.
In the 1840s, the first dental school opened in Baltimore. That really signaled a formalization of the profession. For a variety of reasons, including resistance from the medical school, the dental school was separate. Spielman says with that and the opening of many more dental schools after, dentistry has pretty much followed its own course. During World War II, health insurance really took off in the U.S. It became a way for employers to attract workers. Those plans didn't include dental benefits. That started surfacing separately in the post-war boom.
Bucky Beaver Space Guard!
It was interesting in the 60s, there also began to be a focus by the manufacturers of toothpaste on getting people to the dentist.
Evelyn Ireland is director of the National Association of Dental Plans. She says during that time, toothpaste companies and dental groups started advertising the importance of oral health.
Fresh, clean, and minty. You'll like it. New iPan and toothpaste.
Some dental groups, mainly on the West Coast, created their own dental plans that, by the 70s, joined in as part of the bargaining deals for employee benefits. But remember, health insurance is about having coverage for the worst-case scenarios. These dental plans focused on covering basic cleanings, fluoride services.
Because the 2 dental diseases, cavities or caries, and periodontal disease, which is gum disease, are largely preventable.
The idea was to avoid the need for high-cost things like implants and crowns. And as a person's tooth complications got worse, so too did their share of the cost. For the most part, that's the way it's been to this day. Ireland says the industry's focus on prevention is a good thing. She says their data has found that most people aren't maxing out their coverage. But recent research is showing that more and more people with dental benefits are postponing needed care due to cost. Spielman, with NYU, also says dentists never really had an incentive to join the medical model, especially as they watch their doctor peers lose their independence, joining bigger health systems as health insurers gained more power.
I think that it was a self-preservation, keeping sort of dentistry out of the managed care and in keeping them separate so they can still ensure a good living.
That was a story Alana Gordon reported a while back. Medicine and dentistry, of course, remain separated. And I turned back to internist Netta Freja because I wondered how she sees this division. Do you think of dentists as your colleagues in medicine, or do you think of them as sort of this totally different entity?
It's funny. I do think of them as my colleagues. And yet when I look at the reality of my day-to-day work, I rarely get to interact with them. I'm often asking other specialists for their notes from when they see my patients, whether I'm talking about the orthopedic surgeon or the eye doctor or the cardiologist. I'm chasing down those notes. I'm calling those clinicians to collaborate on my patient's care. And in reality, I don't do that with my patients' dentists. And I should. I mean, this is actually a very helpful conversation because it hopefully will motivate me to do a little bit better. So mentally, I do think of them as colleagues, but my workflow doesn't reflect that as much as it should.
Do you see any signs of dentists and physicians like yourself sort of coming closer together?
I do. I think that there is definitely movement in this direction. So one big area is that more and more medical schools and dental schools are engaging in what's called interprofessional education. So there are more and more opportunities in their curricula to interact with each other, learn together, teach each other, and learn from each other's professors, if that makes sense. So there's a lot more cross-pollination of the two from an earlier age and stage in training. There are also more and more clinic sites and offices where physicians and dentists are co-located. They literally are working out of a shared office space, and I imagine that that would be wonderful for improving those lines of communication.
That's regular Pulse contributor Netta Freja. She is an internist and the host of the Primary Care Reviews and Perspectives podcast. Dentistry and the rest of medicine will have to come closer together and collaborate as dentists are doing more complicated high-tech procedures. Will Stone takes us to Seattle, Washington, where surgeons and dentists are finding new ways to reconstruct the mouth.
For as long as he can remember, Joshua Levinson says his mouth has been changing in some way.
I mean, the mouth is the most intimate piece of real estate. You know, you eat and you breathe and you talk out of your mouth, so any change is incredibly noticeable.
Joshua is 36 years old and lives in Seattle. He moved here after getting a master's degree and studying U.S.-China relations.
I was born with quite a serious bilateral cleft palate, and I've had many surgeries to correct that.
A bilateral cleft lip and palate means there are gaps in the lip and roof of the mouth at birth. Even after multiple operations, Joshua knew he'd eventually need more surgical revisions, and he wanted to improve his profile and the functionality of his mouth. That led him to a rare and advanced type of reconstructive surgery. It involved using a bone graft from Joshua's leg. And his mouth is still getting used to it.
You know, I'll eat something hard, I'll feel this, like, kind of bizarre tingling. So, yeah, I mean, I'm aware of my body sort of, you know, repurposing this graft.
A year out from the surgery, Joshua is happy with the outcome, how he eats and talks, also how he looks.
You know, my profile is a lot better because they really focused on the curvature. So that's amazing.
This high-tech operation is at the intersection of dentistry and general medicine. Doctors use computer modeling, dental implants, prostheses, and the patient's own bone.
And we're talking about trying to reconstruct a jaw to within fractions of millimeters. It's really quite a remarkable technical tour de force.
Tom Dodson is an oral and maxillofacial surgeon and chair of the University of Washington's program. It's a dental specialty that focuses on treating the mouth, jaw, and face. He's also one of the doctors who operated on Joshua.
We essentially cut away the deformed disease part of his jaw and replaced it with new bone in order to repair his cleft lip, cleft palate. And with all due respect, outside of the technology that we could offer as a team, there was really no way to improve his situation without this serious operation.
The Marathon procedure requires a team of specialists with training in dentistry, surgery, or both. They work hand in glove to repair the mouth. Generally, the procedure begins with installing dental implants into a section of the fibula, a thin bone that runs parallel to the shin while it's still in your leg. You wait for the implants to take. Then you harvest that piece of bone from the leg, and then you use it to assemble an upper jaw with special prostheses. Finally, it's hooked up to the patient's arteries and veins.
And that actually all ends up getting sewn over. No one actually ever sees that. They just see the teeth. But you know, as with building a building, the foundation has to be solid and intact in order to put the functional nice parts of the house on top of it.
And then we're now going to scan the lower jaw.
Nearby in his lab at the University of Washington, John Sorensen runs a device across his mouth. It looks kind of like a big electric toothbrush. The color-coded landscape of his mouth appears on the computer screen.
I can look at the biting surfaces of the teeth. The picture is so clear you can actually detect cavities in the teeth.
It's an example of what John dubs the digital revolution in dentistry. This imaging device and similar technology lets you model a mouth and even create a template showing the surgeon exactly where to cut and drill. It feels a bit like graphic design instead of dentistry, which makes John chuckle.
We're more than superficial, right? We're 3D. But that really is what it is, the transformation of prosthodontics, you know, replacement of missing teeth, restoration of teeth in 3D. And doing it virtually.
It's a transformation that Jeffrey Rubenstein has been a part of for more than four decades.
I'm sort of anecdotally referred to as the spare parts department for the medical center.
Jeffrey is director of the University of Washington's Maxillofacial Prosthetic Service, an esoteric specialty. There are only about 250 of them in the country.
So what I try to do is put back what has been taken away or never developed in the first place, or became among the missing because of some untoward event.
Accidents, cancer, or birth defects. Maybe the patient can talk and chew mushy food.
Most people that I encounter left that way wind up finding their way to my doorstep and say, what more can you do other than leave me the way I've been reconstructed?
Jeffrey says this work is really rewarding because you're making someone whole again.
That is a big deal, not only from a functional standpoint, but also from a psychological standpoint, because to be left without an ability to function orally is a huge hit on one's overall psyche.
Not many places in the country do this type of cutting-edge procedure. It's nuanced, interdisciplinary, and expensive. And Jeffrey spends a lot of time fighting to get health insurance to pay for it.
That's the wall we bang our head up against on a regular basis.
A wall in healthcare that separates the mouth from the rest of the body. One that feels especially arbitrary in these extreme, rare circumstances.
I'm lucky I have access to it. I often think about that because I'm sort of at the mercy of the cutting edges of medicine.
Joshua Levinson was able to get insurance to cover his procedure. And he says the results can be life-changing.
You know, it's a huge responsibility because people's faces are so essential in how the world reacts to them.
For The Pulse, I'm Will Stone.
Smile.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jed Slayman, and Steph Yim. Grant Hill is our intern. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund, PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.